So you're on a roll.
I'm on a roll painting, yes.
Oh, yes. We got to close that off.
Do you have to?
We're rolling. Yeah. So you've been on a roll.
I've been on a roll painting. I've been on a painting jag, yeah, for the last maybe 2 months since meeting Katie Heffelfinger, yeah.
And what's that roll feel like?
It's exhilarating. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I'd had roles like this in the past, never sustainable as like this. But when I did those first couple of pieces, like Superman on the Rocks, Autopsy of the Damned, The Wizard of Oz, the Abbey Road piece, all within like a month of each other, a month or two of each other, just like knocking them out. I don't think there was a woman in my life, and if so, I don't think there was, as a matter of fact. Or maybe it was in between women. Or, I don't know. I was just immersing myself. I was just like really on fire artistically, and not necessarily. I didn't have a muse. And I think it kind of shows in those pieces. There's no real feminine distraction, for lack of a better word, except for the. There's no real feminine presence at all in many of those paintings, except for maybe the Wizard of Oz piece. And, of course, there's Dorothy. And so, but that's almost like an archetype, and not necessarily even as a muse or someone that I was thinking about that I wanted to capture in paint. And then there were periods over the years where Susan has stood in as a muse. Not that the work was really any good. There may have been a few things that were exceptional, but overall, compared to what I did at that time in 94, 95, 96, and then now, it almost pales in comparison. It's mediocre. I mean, stuff I'm doing recently, thanks to Katie's influence and inspiration, have been really outstanding, if I can be so bold as to say.
And
so I've been told. So.
And what's going on in these paintings?
Well, they're all dealing with superhero myth, the mythology of the superhero. The contemporary mythology of the superhero, and putting them in different contexts, or taking the context of something that's very familiar to people, like the crucifixion, like the Last Supper, for example, and putting, tweaking them, putting contemporary 20th century icons, pop culture icons, in the stead of Jesus or the apostles or any number of other characters that you could think of. Which is what I've been doing. I mentioned this to Katie on the phone just the other day. I've been doing that since I was a teenager. Just coming out of puberty, I started like in 1977, 78. I started doing parodies of Sunday funnies. Big Dick Tracy, Little Horny Annie, Motley Screw, Natural Blondie.
How old were you?
12. And they were good because I was really trying to hone my skills. So I was drawing exactly like, the styles of the various artists, which is hard. And I was a good mimic. So I was doing them faithfully to the styles of Charles Schulz and Hank Ketchum and Chester Gould, but in these really super hyper sexual and violent, context that a 12-year-old could really appreciate. And I took it to school, and I showed it to the other guys in the bathroom of the gymnasium, actually, after gym, where we were all showering up. I took them out of my bag and figured, I don't know why I thought that, but I thought this would be the perfect place to show these guys this, because I was so proud of it. And I got a few snickers and a few titters, but overall, they were met by the jocks with, you're a pervert, and what makes you do this kind of shit? And they were uncomfortable with their sexuality, because I was doing these gigantic penis creations and these pseudo gay themes and just these hypersexual situations that for their 12-year-old little selves and little minds, they were uncomfortable with. I suppose I thought it hit big with them, but it didn't. So I took it back home, and like a day or two later, I was asleep in my room, and my mother crept in to my room, as she often did, because when you're 12, there are no boundaries.
There should be. Maybe there are in some families, but there were none when I was 12. You know, my mom would come in my room and look at my artwork and listen to what I was singing or whatever. And I didn't mind because she was like my biggest fan. But for this particular group of things, when I woke up from a short nap and heard my family, my mother and some family friends and my father cracking up from the kitchen down the hall. And I peeked down the hall. I realized they were laughing at my cartoons. And I felt so embarrassed. I felt violated. I felt embarrassed. Because I didn't want my mother, more than the other people, my mother, to see this side of me. My sexual emergence. You know?
They were 12 years old.
I was 12 years old. It was almost, it was like being caught masturbating. And in a sense, it was, as an artist, you know? And she really understood it as an artist, but also at the same time, I felt just exposed and violated. So when I got it all back, and she gave it back, said, "This is great, you should do more." Oh, excuse me. I took it back, and instead of saying, "Thanks, Mom, I will," I ripped it all up. I ripped them all up. Out of anger, out of whatever. And I wish I hadn't, because they were really good. Thinking back on it now, I wish I had that.
Did your mother know you ripped them up?
She might have. I think I might have told her. She may have said, she may have invited some more friends over to get high and to read the comics. You know? let's smoke something and read some of Issa's comics. And then when I said I ripped it up, she was very, very, very upset. Hurt. Not angry, but just hurt. Like, "Oh, no, you didn't. No, why? Why?" You know? And I had no answer for her. And I don't think I understood the answer. I don't think I knew why. I just did. That was it. It was gone.
So that was the beginning.
That was the beginning of it, yeah. That was the beginning of it.
Puberty.
Puberty, yeah.
And you never got out of it.
Very good. Very good. I knew you were waiting all day for that line.
Yeah, I was.
You were waiting all day for that line.
I almost waited all year for that line. Forget all day.
That's right. I'm stuck in puberty at 47.
Right. And how does that feel?
It is what it is. I mean, just to be able to craft something like that and... when I started this up again, like in 2011, in January, I was just getting over Leslie. I kind of thought to myself, I said to myself, you know, that's it. It's over. Move on. What do? You paint. So paint. And so I started painting again after not painting for months. I didn't paint anything while I was with her, except that big, gigantic mermaid painting of her, which I later stuck in a closet. But I started doing some small pieces, medium to small pieces, and the first two I did was Betty Boop fucking Popeye, and Dagwood and Blondie fucking. And they were very crude and in-your-face tits and ass and dick going in pussy and glistening dick going. It was really pretty hardcore. And, I just need to get that out. Kind of go there and then pull back and kind of reel yourself in and say, okay, now what do you really want to say? You know, and then I started doing better pieces like Super Sex and Superman and Wonder Woman, which were very well crafted and had no sex at all. I mean, there was a lot of passion. And Wonder Woman looks like she's getting off, but it's really just a very passionate piece that told a deeper story of these two lovers that never were. You know, because in the comic strips, they never got together intimately.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, in the comics, they never got together romantically. They're always like colleagues or, you know, Superman always had Lois Lane, rather, and Wonder Woman always had Steve Trevor, some colonel in the army or some craziness. And they never were romantically linked, ever. So I kind of thought, wouldn't it just make perfect sense for Superman and Wonder Woman to get together? He's a superpowered alien. She's a warrior princess. Who else can handle each other but those two? You know, and they look hot together. They make a perfect couple. So it was just, that harks back to something I did like before I got sick, like in 87, 86, 87. I did another painting called Super Sex, but it was much more It was Superman fucking Wonder Woman, but it was like really, he was really giving it to her, and she was upside down, her legs are akimbo around his head, and there's all sorts of orgasmic shit flowing from her. It was really, I wish I had that one too, that was a good one. But, so I revisited that theme, but a lot less pornographic, I suppose.
Well, are these pornographic?
Some of them...
In your mind?
Not in my mind, no. Not in my mind, but I could see how others... I could very easily
But what goes on in your mind?
What goes on in my mind? Just what-if scenarios. It's not just so much that... well, with the Popeye and Betty Boop piece, that one doesn't really say very much. It's just Popeye fucking Betty Boop after eating some spinach on the side table. You know, which he needs to get it up. That's his Viagra, you know. So in a sense, it's saying that... And it's also because she's such a hot chick, she's also almost like a tramp, or at least a tease, to put it mildly, Betty Boop. And they never did appear together, even though they are from the same era, like the 20s, to teen. They were like silent films, and then they were like cartoons in the 20s and 30s. So it makes sense that they would hook up. I don't think I was saying very much with that one. With the Dagwood and Blondie one, I tried to say a little bit more like, you know, she's got this black dildo under the sheets, and she's reading erotica from an ace and in, you know. And Dagwood is pumping away furiously, you know. And he's got his face is all red, and his eyes are all squinty, and he's like really giving it to her. And she's kind of like taking it, like yeah, like she's giving him, she's letting him get his shit off, but there's really more to her, and it may take more than just Dagwood to get her off. And that says a lot about me. That's kind of how I feel. That's how I've always felt in my relationships, actually. Even though it wasn't even true in most of them, I don't think. But that was always like my Katie and I call Captain Nebbish, the superhero, one of my alter egos. This guy who, you know, is blessed, you know, physiologically, and he knows how to use it, and he's used it well, but he always kind of still feels that he's just not quite hitting it. He's just not quite, you know, conquering the female, you know. So I put myself in the Dagwood place. Not that I want to see Blondie naked, but I am definitely Dagwood, giving it his best, but still feeling that the woman is like, okay, that's nice, but when you're done, I'm going to jerk off. I'm going to use this vibrator to really give myself a real orgasm, sir, you know, while you sleep in a fetal ball, you know, after you've come, kind of thing. I don't know where that comes from. That's just my insecurity, you know. And I've conquered many a woman, but...
What does that mean?
But sexually, you know, I have, you know, dickmatized a few of them. More than a few, maybe.
Dickmatized.
For lack of a better term.
Is that Dick Tracy relationship?
No, meaning, sometimes you'll meet people in your life where they'll string you out because they've just got like some sweet shit down there that just strings you out. And there are going to be times, if you have any prowess at all, where you'll string somebody out. Maybe a few. Maybe more than a few if you're lucky. And I've been lucky. But I think that was a reflection of the Leslie relationship because I don't think I strung her out like how I would have liked to. Or otherwise, she would be calling me and sleeping outside my doorstep kind of thing. Not that I would want that. But I have had that. People climbing in my window and shit like that. So, I mean, that kind of turns your head. That kind of makes you think, oh, well, I can coast on this. And so when people aren't climbing in your window, it makes you wonder, why not? Maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. Maybe I'm not as good as all the people said I was. You just have moments of insecurity. And that's what that Blondie Dagwood piece was, a reflection of my insecurity because I'd lost Leslie. You know, I kind of pulled out of it. And she let it go. And I was happy to be out of it and felt good, I guess, that she let it go. But, I was still thinking about her. I still will mouse over my Google page and see a photograph and go, ah, Leslie. I'll still say, ah, Leslie, you know. Because I think Katie says something interesting. She said, women love first, but men love longer. And there may be a lot of truth to that. And so I don't necessarily pine over her, but certainly at that time, I was like, oh, Leslie, didn't work out. Oh, well, goddamn. You know, just thinking about the great sex that we had and the potential that the relationship could have had had she not been so totally insane. This is the pot calling the kettle black portion of the program.
But sex seems to be a theme that runs through.
Well, sex is really what it all comes down to. That's what the cavemen were doing. They were finding a mate that they could have sex with and have children, and just, you know. So I call a spade a spade. I call it as I see it. You know, it is about sex. And if you can develop a stronger, more fulfilling relationship out of or with that, then you're fortunate and you're lucky. But in the end, it is just a lot of people looking to get off and then hopefully build something after they've gotten off.
And in your art, what do you want people...
Well, it's very visceral. I don't really think too much about... you're asking the wrong person. There are people I know who could really talk art. And when they give interviews, it's like they've got their rap down, you know, about what they're trying to say and whatever. That's one of the things I have to admit I don't do necessarily because I'm not really conscious when I paint. It is also very intuitive. And it may have something to do with the fact that I've been doing it since before I can remember. When my mother was painting these gigantic portraits of Mao Zedong and Fidel Castro in purple and red, monochrome studies of these dictators and revolutionary figures, and she put a starter set of finger paints, which later became watercolors, which later became colored pencils, which later became... Whenever she would paint, she'd have me moving the paint around as a baby while she's painting. So it's so intuitive, it's so integral to who I am, that I can't really say that I went to school to learn how to think like this and put this across on a painting so that you can... I didn't do that. In fact, I didn't go to school to do that. I went to school briefly, and I hated it. Because they were trying to mold me into something that I didn't feel comfortable in. You know? Every teacher that I had...
Art teacher
that I had saw the talent. I'm not saying that I was, like, too talented for them. I don't want to go, that's crazy. Because they've seemed greater. But I just had the bad luck of running afoul of people who just want to put across what they want to put across. And didn't let me do my thing, you know? I just want to do my thing. And I learned a little bit, but I more often didn't learn as much as I should have. You know, which is why I never got my degree. I don't know if I ever will go back and get it. But I don't know if I need it, quite honestly. At the level, I'm going to sound conceited, but I think I'm at a level of capability at this point where I don't know if I really need to go back to learn anything.
For what?
For art.
For what?
For what? I don't know. There's something that Katie said the other day. The one thing she, like, quoting The Wizard of Oz, which was very cute of her. One thing that she doesn't have, a diploma. You know, like the quoting Oz when he gave the Scarecrow his diploma. Who was already as smart as a whip, but he didn't have that piece of paper. He didn't have his degree to kind of make him feel like he was something. And that's something that, I don't know if that's the reason she wants to do it, but she definitely wants to get her degree. She wants to get that diploma. I don't necessarily feel a compulsion to do that. I don't necessarily feel, you know... It might enhance my earning power if I were to get a job doing something that would involve having a degree that would... who knows where your life will turn out and where you end up feeling like, wow, I should have got my degree, huh? But but right now...
You and the Scarecrow.
Me and the Scarecrow. Yeah. But right now...
That's your next painting. Scarecrow holding his degree.
Saying, where's yours, motherfucker?
Right. With it. And the other hand, he's got a mirror with your face in it. And he's talking to himself. And he's a scarecrow. Yeah. Yeah. But I think there's a lot of insight into your spiritual as well as surreal symbolism. Is the word I'm looking for.
Mm. It's all very unconscious or subconscious. I never quite know which one to say, so I always say subconscious, unconscious.
because it's one of those two. Maybe it's both of them. But it's all going on in that other 90% of the brain that I have no control over. And that's the beauty of it. And I don't want to ever stop that or tap into it. Because once you know, I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that once you know what you're doing, you cease doing it in a way that is pure. You know? I mean, I hate to go back to the Beatles, but I often do. Paul needed John. Because John was raw rock and roll. He could barely play his instrument, but he was rock and roll. He was rebellion. He was the real deal. His mother died. He hated his father. He was just like a roiling ball of rock and roll energy. But Paul knew a little bit about theory, a little bit about this, not as much as he should have, but a little bit. So together, they were just an unbeatable force writing songs. And in those early years, that's when they wrote their best stuff. As Paul progressed, and as they became the Beatles, and he started to really learn the rules, his music turned to shit. Because he became writing music for grandmothers. You know, because he ceased to coast. I hate to say, and not to say you shouldn't learn things, but sometimes that inspiration where you don't know where it's coming from and you don't know where it is and it just hits you, and if you can run with that and sustain that for a considerable period of time, that's where the magic happens. But once, if I were I don't know, I'm not saying I'm an idiot, but if I don't know, if I'm afraid to go to school and learn things that I kind of already know how to do, but learn the names of them or learn the concepts.
Learn the right way of doing it, and you're on the same road and route that everybody has got this rut in.
Yeah,
like for me, I like not knowing about things because then I like discovering things that maybe other people hadn't seen. But once you, and I happen to be an inventor, as you know, but once the thing that I know too much, I'm gone.
Yeah.
You know, if I think I know something, and I look at other people and they don't have curiosity and they don't have that intuitive. So I appreciate your insights into the fear of being
Overeducated or losing that intuitive spark, losing your intuition, losing that thing that I've had since I was a child that is almost a spiritual thing that allows me to paint. And paint what I want, and paint what I think about, and what I don't even think about, or know that I'm thinking about. I don't ever want to be the kind of guy who says, "Yes, I'm going to do a relational thing that has to some long highfalutin," which is bullshit. You know, something that's thought up. I'd much rather go with my guts, go with something that's coming from somewhere that I have no control over, than think about doing something.
So can you talk
something conceptual art? I hate conceptual art.
Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in your mind?
I don't. No, I don't.
You have a seed of an idea when you're starting something.
Yes, but it's, you know,
then it changes.
You know, I'll tell you. It's just weird. I don't want to sound like I'm greater than anything else, other than anybody else, but it's just this stuff that goes on when it's almost like I'm in a dream state when I think of paintings. It's almost like I'm in a dream state, and what comes out, and it's there, but it's almost like I don't think about it. I just do it. And Katie has encouraged me to take photographs of my work in progress, which I never did. I never did that. I couldn't bear doing that. But I see the value in it. And it makes it much more of an artistic process than a magical process. Which is uncomfortable. But I see the value in it. And she's explained it, and I do see the value in it. But I often liked thinking of something and in 2 or 3 days making it happen, and there it is. And then you present it, and it's like, bang, look at this. And people are like, oh, shit, look at that. And that's the reaction I've always gotten since I was a child. Showing it to my family, then showing it in school, then showing it to various other people along the way, and being in a hospital. And but I don't want to lose the magic of just thinking something and creating it. Not to say that taking photos of it in its in-between state will do that, but
I sometimes have to get used to. And there is a certain magic in looking on your phone and seeing it in stages come develop. But like I said, it makes it more of an artistic process. It makes it and less of a spiritual, magical, otherworldly process.
Yeah. How much does validation play in your work?
I'm well aware of what I'm capable of, more or less. I know I'm a good artist, but it feels good when people recognize it. And like I can't say enough. I really can't say enough. Katie has influenced me beyond measure, and just her entering my life. I really needed her to enter my life at this stage, to be if not a romantic distraction, for lack of a better word. Which later becomes a muse, but more so just to be someone whose opinion I respect and who's coming from a professional perspective, who can say to you, I see this in your work. You might need to do this, that, and that. Paint more, or just do that, or just kind of make suggestions, subtle suggestions, not edicts at all, like Janos would often do, which would make me kind of move in the other direction. But just like suggestions that would encourage and make me want to paint more and better, you know? And when I do a piece that was better than the last one I do, she'd say, that's much better. You're really growing. I look at the growth. Do you see that? And I'd go, why? I kind of do, yeah. And she'd say, well, maybe just keep doing that and do more of that. And if something, it was something to be exceptionally good, she'd say, that's really good. And then there were maybe two or three others afterward that were like runoff pieces, like I mentioned before. Like we're just kind of like, something after a great masterpiece that are good but not as good, and then you're ready to come back strong with something else. And we'd have these long conversations about this process. And being an artist herself, whose work I really respect, it just allows for a better relation to what she's talking about in terms of my art. And so I really owe her a great deal.
Well, the question I
so have... as far as validation, getting back to your question. You can coast on your own. You can coast on your own thing for so long before you definitely need someone to step in and say, "Yeah, that's pretty good." You know, let's see more of that. Or, it feels good to be validated. It feels good to know you're on the right track, or know that you're doing something that, if it's something that's different from you're doing, maybe someplace you need to go more frequently.
When did you know this as a kid?
Know what?
That you were had a good sense of this
from as early as I can remember. It's almost like my mother willed me, or my parents wanted me to be an artist, and it just happened.
My father
was a musician, but he was also an artist, a cartoonist, and I never saw him do any like formal painting. But he was a very, very gifted cartoonist, very good cartoonist. He had his own style, and he had a very interesting take on things, very funny at times, and plays on words, odd plays on words, you know.
You remember?
I do remember those things. And he, after a while, he'd have me do some of his cartooning with him. We did try to collaborate on some things, you know.
How old were you then?
12, 13.
So you've had this...
Yeah, from as early as I can remember... I guess they recognized, even from when I was a child and drawing things, I remember in kindergarten, I don't know how old you are in kindergarten, but I drew a picture of my kindergarten teacher dancing with Godzilla on the Empire State Building. And I drew her checkered miniskirt. Back this must have been 1969, 1970 when they wore miniskirts, you know. I must have been like 5 or 6. And it was a child's drawing, but it was very good for a child's drawing. And more so than remembering the first time in my family where they said, wow, you're a very good artist, I remember her freaking out and being so impressed at that drawing. I'd been drawing for a while before that. This is why she asked me, could you draw something? I hear you're an artist. Could you draw something? So my mother must have said, he's an artist. So when she asked me, could you draw something, I sat down and drew that for her, and she was just like amazed. So I remember that, being in kindergarten and having her give me a lot of praise. And then I went through a contentious relationship, like in junior high school, when I didn't like the attention. You know, When you're junior high school, what are you, 12, 13, 14 years old? You're a teenager, you're going through puberty, you're going through those changes, you know, and those were one of the changes I was going through. I was sick of the praise. I was sick of the attention. I didn't want the attention, you know. I was kind of disaffected and going through that whole punk rock thing also at that time, so I was kind of surly and withdrawn. And so, I needed to paint, and I loved to paint. I had to paint, but I didn't like to paint in front of people. I didn't like people looking at me painting. And that stayed with me to this day. I usually don't like people watching me paint.
Can you talk about your first girlfriend?
My first girlfriend, huh? Well, that's a mixed bag, because I had a first sexual experience. But she wasn't my girlfriend. I tried getting her to be Crystal Toba, daughter of Queenie, who was the neighborhood crack whore. When crack happened, she was the crack whore. Before crack happened, she was just like the neighborhood freaky weirdo who was a little too promiscuous and really a little too loud.
The mother,
yeah. And the daughters were like really kind of affected by their mother's brashness and devil may care. And she's actually, you know, thinking back, she was a free spirit. But she got a little too free. Sometimes you gotta know when to reel it in. And Queen didn't know how to reel it in. That's basically it. I shouldn't put her down. But, because people would look at my mom as being a free spirit. But my mom knew how to reel it in, you know. But Queenie was just off the chain. And her daughter, she used to send her daughters to come and play with us. And her oldest daughter, who was my age, Crystal, deflowered me. Actually, you know, I was supposed to be deflowered by her upon graduating junior high school. But she took me into the closet, and it was dark, and we were standing, and she was ready for it. But I didn't quite know how to put it in. I've never known how to do it that way. Standing up face to face, unless you lift them up and lower them upon your penis. Which, you know, that's the way to do it. But if there's little closet space, you can't do that. I cannot fuck somebody standing face to face, front to front. You know, with like very little space. And so that's how I blew my first potential sexual experience.
With the same woman.
With Chris, with same girl, Crystal, same. Yeah. That would have been when I was like 14, maybe? 14, 15? And I blew that. And 2 years later, she came back around the house at one of the houses. My mom and dad used to throw these wild parties for all the jazz folk and all the pot smoke. And,
who would come to these parties?
Oh, all sorts. Lots of people who were lesser known people like my dad, who were the lesser known. But occasionally, Clark Terry would breeze through. Betty Carter would breeze through. Billy Taylor. You know, those are the three who I remember coming over more than once. My dad was big friends with the Adderley brothers, Cannonball and his brother. And they may have come over once, but I don't remember.
Hold on a second. Sir, you were talking about Crystal,
that was my first. I can't really say she was my. Yeah, she wasn't my first girlfriend. I tried to make her my girlfriend, and she went with Dwayne Harris instead. He beat me out. He was a bigger guy, kind of jockey, big. He, you know, big and late. I saw him later, like in my 20s, before I got sick. He passed by the house once or twice, and he was in great shape. He was always like doughy and fattish, biggish. As a teenager, but as an adult, he blossomed into quite a impressive young man, very muscular, and he was from the island. I forget which island he was from. So he had a discipline about him, as most island kids do. You know, their parents really kind of really keep them on the straight and narrow more often than not. And so he turned out to be a good kid, good man. But I hated his guts when he stole my girlfriend, you know, or he was the more impressive find. Even though I'd known her for longer, because I'd been around the block from her all those years, and her mom knew my mom, and they'd smoke together and everything. But she saw Dwayne as something I wasn't, I guess, which is very much what he was. You know, I was kind of like a free spirit, artsy kid, and he would show up in suits or, you know, he was, you know, West Indian. You know.
But so you were talking about your first encounter.
Yes, yeah, so that was, yeah, my first encounter was with her. That was my first failed encounter. And then sometime when I was like 16, she came into the back room at one of my family's parties where her mother was getting high and feeling up all the men. And she came to the back room, and we got it on. And I had a condom there, too, which I don't even know why I even had it. Because I wasn't having sex with anybody, but somehow I had a condom. And we had sex, and the condom broke, which is a precursor to many good things in my life. No, but I put in her, and we did intercourse, and then it broke. And then she said, well, it's okay, put it in my ass. I was like, really? And it went very easily up there, and that was very exciting. And then she said, I'm going to be sick. I'm going to be sick. And she said, take it out. I'm going to be sick. And so I took it out, and that was it. And that was my first... And it's interesting. There's a photograph somewhere, which I wish... In a weird way, I wish I weren't on the outs with my family, because there's access to so many great photographs. Not just having photographs of your parents and your family and of me as a child, but there's one photo. My brother came in just as I withdrew and zipped up, and she straightened her clothes. He burst into the room, ta-da style, with a camera and started snapping photographs. And there was a photograph of me with a big smile on my face after this conquest, or whatever you could call it, and her in the background, smiling. And that was the photograph of that moment, of that night, you know. So that would be great to have.
Have you painted that?
No, I wish I could. I'd have to see it again. I would know the 16-year-old me, you know, 16-year-old Lisa and 16-year-old Krista.
And what was, she was 16 too?
She was 16, yeah. But she was very knowledgeable in the ways of the world. Just judging by how she took it up the behind, that was just like, whoa. Took it like a champ.
And you didn't even know about that.
I heard a little something about that along the way. Mm-hmm. I'd always had a predilection for that. I'd always wanted to do that, and it's been a part of my repertoire ever since. But I was just, you know, I don't know.
And so that was the only time you had sex with her?
That was it. That was it, yeah. That was it. She just wanted to be my first.
Is that what she said?
I think her mother might have put her up to that. And she did everything her mother said, including smoke crack with boys in the backseat of their car. I mean, it gets really hairy.
Well, did
later on.
Was it because they weren't sure about your sexual orientation?
That could have been it, too. Or who knows?
I mean, your mother could have said, you know...
No, my mother and her weren't... I doubt that
you
was
think,
the kind
of... Or your father maybe put her...
My father didn't really like Queenie either. No one liked Queenie. She came to the parties because somehow she'd get in and she'd bring a bag of smoke. More often, she wouldn't bring a bag of smoke, you know. But she somehow got into these parties and found herself laughing and joking and hearing the music and coming in through the side door and coming in, sitting down. Hey, how you doing? What's up? My name's Queenie. You look good. Where's the wine? Blah, blah. I got who's the reefer? Who got the reefer? Blah, blah. Let me roll that up. Blah, blah. You know, she just is just like this real character who ended up getting into parties. You know, like some people can get into parties. Women, there are women out there today who will be the queenies of tomorrow, who can just get into parties and hang out, and no one really knows how they got there, who they are, or no one really likes them or wants to know them, but they just end up being there. And they are the life of the party in a way, and they make it more interesting. In a depraved sense, you know, because they're feeling everybody up and commenting on this one's bulge and that one's tits, and you just look at my tits, and she take them out, and yeah, you know, there are people like that, and Queenie was like that, you know? Life of the party.
Now, and you were saying that Betty Carter and Clark Terry,
Yeah, they came over more than once. I remember they were over more than once.
You were in Queens, so Louis Armstrong.
My dad, they say he never used to come over to people's houses, from what I understand. And, he always just liked people to come to his house. And he died like in the early 70s. I don't remember ever. My dad used to tell stories. He tells stories about Duke Ellington, how he met Duke, how he met Louis Armstrong. He used to go to Armstrong's house, and how Armstrong used to like to entertain, but he wouldn't like to go over to people's houses or something.
He liked to smoke, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they all went over there. That's why they all smoked.
Yeah, you're out of it. But you didn't start smoking until...
Not until I was 22. But I caught plenty of contact highs all my life. You know, all my life. I was running around the house while there was a cloud of smoke just like lingering. And there were like 20 or 30 people playing instruments and running around the house and cooking and sitting and sifting some different rooms. And there's like a cloud of smoke all over the house. I'm running around, breathing it all in. So, yeah.
And you talk about drawing under the table.
Yeah, after running around, I get tired and I draw. I sit under the table and draw while they're all smoking above the table, and I'm under the table drawing with my crayons and my colored pencils and my markers. More often, I didn't like markers too much because my brother, Smile, was very into markers. He was a graffiti hound, and he's even a vandal. You know, he'd get arrested and all that stuff. He was very into that in the mid and late 70s. And so I wasn't much into markers, but I was more into, I hate to say this, real art. Yeah, even though graffiti very much is an art, but at the time I saw it as just like pure vandalism, straight up vandalism, especially what he was doing. He wasn't making those great, beautiful pieces that you see. He was just writing some bullshit tag all over things, all over the bus, the back of the bus, and on the subways. And
how old was he?
He was maybe 4 years older than I was, 4 or 5 years older than I was.
You're the youngest?
Yes.
Of how many kids?
5 kids.
And so you're going along, you're painting, you're going to school, you were doing some modeling, I think.
My mom, when I was a kid, wanted me to be the next Rodney Allen Rippey, who, if you don't remember who Rodney Allen Rippey was, in the early 70s, he was this adorable little black kid who used to sell Burger King hamburgers. He was the black answer to Mikey. Hey, Mikey! He likes it, hey, Mikey! Who was a Life cereal kid. He was a kid who... adorable little white kid. And so for the black kids, they came up with Rodney Allen Rippey. And my mom saw him, and she said I'll never forget today, she said, I was 4 or 5 years old, she says, you're much cuter than he is, and much smarter. We're going to make you a star. And so she took me to various, she took me to get headshots made, and took me on go-sees, and auditions, and they all liked me, and I was a very cute kid. Very cherubic, apple-cheeked, curly-haired, very cute, and precocious. I was pretty smart for my age, but I couldn't remember my lines.
That's unusual, because you have an amazing memory, as far as I know.
But I can't remember any of my songs. I need my books for my songs. So I remember things that I guess I need to remember, or maybe not need to remember, but something that I just don't remember.
Well, you have an encyclopedic memory of music.
Yeah.
And comics, I bet.
Yeah, and movies, and television. Media. I'm a big media hound. Well, I've taken in as a child that means something to me. I tend to remember it. I remember seeing single episodes of one thing that was only shown once in life, and I hold on to it, even though I could probably find it on YouTube or on the internet, but I have a memory of it that's almost better than what you could probably find on YouTube, because it's just something I remember seeing.
I mean, I would walk down the street with you, and you pick out John Turturro from. We walk right by him, and he's.
Yeah. I have an eye for that. But I just. Some things I don't remember. I can't remember any songs that I've written, unless I have the paper in front of me. And then it's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. And then I can go into it. And when they were putting the lines in front of me to read, I would read them, then they take the paper away, and I'm like, and making up my own shit, and they say, no, read the line, read it, have them read it again. And I remember my mom was getting a little embarrassed, and they were getting frustrated at my one big audition. I went on a few, but there was one that I think I could have nailed, because they really liked me, my look, but I couldn't for the life of me want to remember these lines. I don't know what I was reading, either. But I just couldn't remember, and I failed the audition. And that was the last audition my mom took me on.
Yeah, probably good.
Yeah, I think so.
Otherwise, rather it could have been the next Michael Jackson.
The next Michael Jackson. R and I?
Oh, right. Yeah, keep on forgetting.
No. But yeah, that would have been tragic had she just kept hammering me into it, or taking me home and having me read the lines. Because that's what some stage mothers do. They'll say, okay, they'll ask the people.
Beat it into you.
Beat it into you, yeah. Have you take it home a week beforehand or a month beforehand, have you read it and read it and read it and read it, so you just can't read anything else. And yeah, so I'm glad she didn't take that route.
So.
But as far as other modeling, years later I became a nude model. Yeah, at the Art Students League and School of Visual Arts.
So there's paintings and sculptures.
Somewhere out there my dick is hanging. No, wait a minute.
That's Dick Tracy.
That didn't sound right. No, but somewhere out there, yeah, there's plenty of pictures of me. I was doing it for like a year and a half. High as a kite. And there are some instances where I'd go to Central Park and get blazed, just get so fucking high, stumble back into the Art Students League, take my clothes off and have a raging heart on, just stand there like Superman with a raging heart, and they'd be painting it. And so those I'd be interested in seeing, because I just for the look on my face, which is probably one of such, who knows what, you know, such just like
now
defiance and
part of your art was influenced by your smoking.
I don't know.
As you got older, at 22, why didn't you smoke before that?
I just didn't particularly care for it. Everybody in the house did it, and I said it made me feel uncomfortable. I don't know why, but it just made me feel uncomfortable. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that I could be wrong, but Katie and I even talked about this, but I really hold fast to the fact that I really felt like I wasn't really in proper contact with my parents or my family. They were always high. When you're high, it's not like when you're straight. You know, and maybe to be high is the way to be for some people, and it certainly was for them. But I just felt out of contact with them. I just didn't feel like I had a proper contact with them. I didn't feel like there was like a, I don't know. I just felt really alien to them and to my environment.
Starting at how old?
I don't know. From as old as I can remember. And then when I could be wrong, but when I witness other kids with their parents, other parents relating to their children, I find myself thinking, oh, why can't I have that? That seems so, I don't know. And that's not to say I would want to change anything, because growing up in an artistic household, an artistic musical, hippie, bohemian, black bohemian intelligentsia, you know, that's pretty fucking cool. But there are trade-offs to everything. And I guess one of the trade-offs was that I really felt not connected to them. Not at all connected to them.
Even though you were connected to your mother?
Incredibly so. Symbiotically so, yeah.
As an artist?
As an artist, as a person.
As someone who influenced you?
Yeah, yeah. And she knew it, and I knew it. And it was just like tacit. It was like something we both understood, and we both cruised on it, and it was great. It was great.
Did you paint together sometimes?
I went to her a lot for advice, or she, or if she saw me painting or thinking of something or coming up with something, she, in the right way, in much the same way Katie does, which is why I really appreciate Katie, in much the same way, she'd suggest something that was always on point, always the right thing to do. And if I didn't follow it, I may have followed my own muse, but I would think to myself, well, Mom's idea was good too. But I want to try this kind of thing. You know? She had a flawless eye.
Let's hold on a second here.
If I don't like it, I'll tell you.
All right. So, in a more intimate sense, your smoking was kind of unusual for you.
Only because I grew up not liking it or just not being a fan of it, and all of a sudden I'm smoking, and yeah, in a weird way, it was weird because it felt very natural because I'd been around it all my life. I'd known the smell, I'd known the feeling, But there was a part of me, I don't know, maybe it was the Republican part, because we all have them. There was a part of me that was like, oh, this is not right. This is not. This is so not you. This is so not a look. And I wasn't a very good pot smoker. I wasn't cool. I'd get goofy, and I guess that's the way some people get, although my parents didn't get that way. They got cooler. All the people who came around them got cooler. But somehow, I was a goof. I was like, and I knew it. You know, it's like I knew it. And I was like, why am I smoking this? I'm such an asshole. Pass that joint. I'm such a fucking asshole. I can't believe. Light that up. Pass it over here. Give me. So I just found my. I just realized. I knew I was really just not a refined pot smoker. But I fell into it because it was just the way it was.
You want to talk about your father?
Well, yeah, I started smoking after he passed away. The day after he passed away. My brother and a family friend were up in my bedroom watching Star Trek and laughing their asses off. And they saw me, I just walked in, and I was kind of dazed and kind of morose. And they said, you want to try this? It might help. And I said, sure. And I felt much better. And I was laughing with them at Captain Kirk having a fight sequence. It was the funniest thing. And it was an awakening. It was an awakening. And I remember when my mom came upstairs to fetch us to go bury, to actually prepare my father's death body for burial. I kind of wanted to say to her, now I know why you smoke. Now I know why you smoke. Now I know. But I was kind of embarrassed. Yeah. Kind of embarrassed. I don't know why I should have been, but I was.
And why do you think they smoked? Why did you?
Why did?
What was the?
Oh, just because it was such a freeing experience. It was such a release. It's like we're all in straitjackets, marijuana or any drug, or alcohol, frees you for a moment. Before it works its magic on you and does other things that maybe aren't that cool. But for a moment, it frees you from the straitjacket of life. You know?
Just a kind of a sidebar. You're not a big proponent of marijuana. Let's get that out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, only because I've seen plenty of brothers. When I got sick and did what I got so sick that I had to end up in a mental hospital. I saw plenty of brothers coming in there, not from crack, but straight weed, or whatever they were putting in, formaldehyde, who knows what they were putting in the weed in the 80s and the 90s. But there were plenty of brothers coming in there, fucked up on weed, insane, in the membrane, as the song goes, and that's a marijuana song.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you know it, you know it, but if you don't know it, you don't know it. There was a big group that came out called Cypress Hill, their whole overt was marijuana songs. You know?
Like Cheech and Chong or something?
But more like in a hardcore rap, hip-hop way.
In what year was this?
Early 90s. Around the same time that all these brothers were coming in fucked up on weed. So apparently something was being put in that weed that was driving people crazy, that drove me crazy, and was driving other people crazy.
Now, from the time you started smoking, and you kind of laughed when you said you wound up in a mental hospital.
Only because it's uncomfortable laughter. I don't know how deep you want to go into it. Yeah, I mean, I committed a crime that allowed me to... I committed a crime while insane. Whatever the influence was the influence. I lost my mind, committed a crime, had to take the insanity plea, and end up spending a considerable amount of time in a mental hospital.
20 years?
Almost 20 years. 19 years.
How did that define your paintings?
I did some interesting work, and I did a lot of crap, or a lot of very mediocre work. I mean, in the scheme of things, I don't know. I mean, maybe in another 20 years or 25 years, when I'm in my 60s, or at the end of my career, I kind of think that maybe, much like a jigsaw puzzle, all of your artwork will somehow form the template of your life, or the tapestry of your life, even. And so, the stuff I did while in the hospital is the stuff I did while it was very much hospital stuff. You know? It's
what do you mean?
It's reflective of, a lot of it is reflective of where I was and what I was going through.
What were you going through?
What can you, anything you can imagine while being in a mental hospital. I mean, I don't know how deep you want to go. I mean, just, it's so innumerable, just the daily indignities that I guess a black person of a certain age has gone through. That maybe, I don't think, in this day and age, they're going through. But African-American art from people of the 60s and early 70s and a little bit beyond is reflective of the daily indignities that they had to go through as black people in America. And a lot of my art was indicative of what I was going through as not only just a mental patient in a butcher shop, but also a black mental patient in a butcher shop, you know? So, it was what it was. And it's changed a lot. Now that I'm out, I'm washing a lot of that off. I'm washing a lot of that off. And you don't see any of the mental health themes, you know? There was a period when I was straitjacket heavy. You know, there's a lot of paintings where it was me in a straitjacket being attacked by this, that, and the other person. But I've gone past that.
Can you talk a little bit about the Cosmic Knockout?
The Cosmic Knockout...
Which is where before that. Cosmic Knockout can be considered almost a graphic novel.
Cosmic Knockout is details my last great decompensation. It's a detail of that's what it was, a cosmic knockout. It was a cosmic knockout, and it was just like my last great flip out, and all the things I thought about, and all the things I saw, all the things I thought I saw, all the web of intrigue and lies I was telling myself and believing, just all of the schizophrenic nonsense I was going through in 1997, 98.
Can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
It was madness. It was insane. It was hell. It was hell. And that's what the book is about, me going to hell. And the hell is really the basement of my old home. That's really the when he goes to hell and meets Satan, it's not hell he's in, but it is a type of hell. It's the basement of his own home, where he has to get through the conjoined zombies of his family and confront his mother again. And beg for forgiveness. Yeah. And he discovers that he has it. But it's still going to take a little while to heal and get out. So that's where the Cosmic Knockout ends. It's not a happy ending. You know, he's got her forgiveness, but he still has to heal. You don't just get forgiveness and heal. You get forgiveness and take a while to kind of still get over what you got to get over and then get the hell out of this hospital. And it took many years after that story was written and finished to get out of the hospital. So it wasn't a traditional happy ending.
Now, there is a kind of a superhero.
Well, yeah, being a big fan of DC and Marvel Comics and comics in general, and growing up on that stuff, when I got sick, I became a superhero. But without the powers.
What do you mean without the powers?
I was on 1-to-1. I'll never forget. And I kept asking.
What do you mean 1-to-1?
The 1-to-1 meaning like at arm's length, there's an aide who watches you 24 hours and documents every hour what you're doing. Patient is asleep. Patient appears to be asleep. That's what they write. Patient appears to be asleep. Patient has gone to bathroom. Patient is in shower. Patient is in laundry room doing laundry. Patient is in the dining room eating meal. They document relentlessly. I was in such a state that they had me on 1-to-1. And I remember in this whole frenetic fantasy to be this superhero, going to the bathroom and splashing my face and looking in the mirror and say, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. Superstar, 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 superstar. You know, like trying to somehow become the hero and get the hell out of there. Because I was imagining all this shit going down on the ward. Like, everybody had been turned into a zombie or a vampire or a flesh eater or Black Frankenstein and White Frankenstein and the Wolfman and the Creature from the Black... All these creatures were... I'm surrounded by all these creatures who were the patients and the staff and the doctors. One doctor was a giant scorpion in a three-piece suit. You know? Just insane stuff. And I'm like, get me out of here! Super sub! The aide was just standing there like, are you done? Are you finished? I think, no, give me another minute. Super sub!
Splashing. You saying this aloud?
Aloud! Little staring in the mirror, like, come on, let's do it!
And the aide
is like, okay, look, you know, it's the middle of the night, let's go back to bed.
So you were really pretty out there, weren't you?
Oh, very. I was totally psychotic. Not dangerously so, because I don't think I'm dangerously psychotic. I think what happened with my mom, or what happened with, you know, when I committed the crime, was a total accident. Total dumb luck. Just a total accident, because I'm not a violent person, and it was not a violent... But when I've gotten sick every single time since then, it's been very bizarre, but not in a violent or dangerously psychotic way. But extremely bizarre.
Bizarre.
Extremely. To the extreme. Bizarre to the extreme.
And that shows in some of your paintings, doesn't it?
I don't know if I've ever really captured... I think you'd have to put all my paintings up on a wall and display... Because that's how the sick mind is. It's like so many thoughts at once. And you could split into two and three and four people, which is what happened to me. I was a minstrel, documenting all this in song. I was a superstar. I was a tar baby. I was like, and I was me. I was like so many different characters. Watching all this transpire, I think that may be one way to mount a show, even if I ever become notable enough to do a show to capitalize on the last 20 years in the hospital, is to put it all up on a wall in a very, not haphazard at all. In a very detailed way, but that would probably best encapsulate what it's like to lose your mind. All that stuff going on, especially the cosmic knockout paintings. All that stuff, the mastodon coming out of the bubble, the spaceship, which emerges out of the Niagara Falls, which is on television. I'm watching this on television. Yeah, I'm saying, you see that? Because while I was watching TV, we were watching it on a fuzzy set. So, you know where this is going. So while they're all watching this TV and trying to make sense of what's going on, I'm seeing like a second transmission go on underneath what's being transmitted, especially for me, to let me know that the bubble is coming from Niagara Falls to pick me up. So it was just insane. It was just craziness.
Yeah. And you believe that?
Totally. I was getting dressed for it. I'd ask the 1-1-8, can I go to my room? I want to change my clothes. Why do you want to change your clothes? I wouldn't tell them. I said, I just want to put on something a little more, you know, better for going outside. You're not going outside. Well, in case I were to go outside, I want to dress. And he said, what are you talking about? I just want to, can I change my clothes? Can I change my clothes, please? Okay, we'll change your clothes. So it was always a fight with them because they never, I was a real problem on 1-to-1. There's some people who sleep on 1-to-1 because they're doped up. But because I was on medication, I was fighting medication over objection all that time. So I wasn't medicated. So I was totally off the chain. And I was a problem to them. I was a problem. And I could tell some of them took it in stride, and some of them just came to work and realized their job is to get up and open the doors for people. So they treated it as just, you want to open your door? Okay, fine. 2 minutes later, you want your door open? Sure, okay. That was their job. Some people took it as their job. Others who like to sit on their ass, like, oh, you must be joking. In your room again? What do you want to do now? And they'd give me a hard time. You know? I ain't going till change of shift. Maybe then. If I'm around, kind of thing, yeah.
So I have to. Were you painting then?
I wasn't painting. When I get sick, I don't paint. There's a brief period when I'm getting sick where I start to paint.
Well, I have one of your paintings that I had to rescue.
Yeah, there's a brief period where I tend to overwork. And I've done some paintings that were really good, but I overworked them and they became mud on the canvas. That were really, really good. But I just didn't know when to stop. And I just keep laying the paint on, and just moving paint, and just before it just becomes like a grayish, brownish mess.
But you could see in there.
I knew what it was.
And I was decoding. You know, I was doing a lot of decoding and covert activities so that people couldn't tell what I was painting and so forth. Yeah. It's tough being a secret agent superhero.
And when you look back on that period,
it was what it was.
Can you believe that it's you?
Sure, sure, sure.
Now, what's your diagnosis?
Well, right now it's paranoid schizophrenia, chronic type. But I think it's been changed since I've been doing so well as to psychotic disorder in remission.
In remission. About remission. How do you feel about narcissism being taken out of the DSM-5?
Well, it's a little too late. It should have been taken out when I was inside so that I could have gotten out a little sooner. Because they were using that to beat me about the head, boy. They were using that to beat me about the head. We don't want you to go to a living museum full time because it feeds your narcissism. I'm like, what? Where do you want me to go? Living and learning center where you learn how to cook. Are you kidding, right? No, I'm serious. So I learned how to cook, which I already knew how to do, so I ended up doing all the cooking for everybody. And what else was I doing? I became one of the leaders, one of the co-leaders, which later which was the beginning of my peer counselor career.
Tell me a little bit. So you're now a peer counselor.
Certified peer counselor.
But in the institution, where do you think, really, people who are melting down, bugging out, where do they get their support?
From their peers. They don't trust the staff. I didn't trust the staff. And I've noticed that there's a very small percentage of people who, when they get sick in the hospital, will trust the staff, or definitely not the doctors. Maybe the staff, maybe the hands-on Mahata types, the treatment aides, they may trust them to a degree. But they definitely don't trust the doctors. Unless they've just totally drunk in the Kool-Aid and they'll go with any kind of okie-dokie give them. But more often than not, they'll trust their peers. And if you have a peer who can come in and kind of talk to you and relate to you, and they know you've been where they're at, or there's a simpatico, or they know that you understand where they're coming from, you may get better results than putting somebody in there who doesn't know where they're coming from and starts threatening them with Mid-Hudson. That was one of the big threats in Creedmoor. Keep this up, we're going to send you to Mid-Hudson. You'll be on the first bus to Mid-Hudson. And I'd been to Mid-Hudson, yeah. So,
And what's Mid-Hudson?
That's like a secure facility, mentally ill. That's like a hospital for the criminally insane.
Where you've been there?
I was there. It's embarrassing to say, but when I first got the plea, for the insanity plea, it's a prerequisite. They have to send you to Mid-Hudson. If you plead insanity after committing a crime, that's like, yeah. You don't go to Creedmoor.
And how long were you there?
I was only there for like 15 months, which is pretty good. I mean, actually extremely good, considering that people have done 8-10... People are still there, who I was there with, who were very, very sick. And some people who were really pretty well adjusted, but didn't quite know how to get out of the system, were there like 6, 8, 10 years, you know? Because it was just hard to get out of there. But they saw that I was doing so well, I was responding very well to the medication. The fact that it was very well understood that the nature of the crime was accidental, that I wasn't walking around New York City streets with a 5-gallon drum with somebody's head in it, talking to it. You know, I mean, those kind of people stay there for a very long time. But the fact that it was my mom, they understood it was an accident and that I was a decent guy, I wasn't an asshole, they gave me a play. And I got in 15 months.
What's it like being in a mental institution?
You mean Creamo or Mid-Hudson?
Well, just in general. I mean, if it's somebody who's going to listen to this and they, you know, especially if they're in the art or comic world, what do you tell people it's like being...
I don't, actually. I realize that the more distance I put between myself in that period, the more distance there is and the less likely I am to talk about it. I mean, when I first got out, that's all I was talking about, because that's all I knew. 20 years of my life. My 20s and my 30s. And half of my 40s. Which were spent in a mental house. So, I mean,
So, yeah, that's all I knew. But now that it's a little bit of distance, I realize I don't have to talk to anybody about it. I don't have to say anything about it. It's not really that important. Until it's important. You know what I mean? Until it can be used for good.
Well, there's a common misconception, you know, psychophobia. Talk about a little bit about that.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, given the dynamics of your art and the amount of time you spent and the...
I wouldn't say I do mentally ill art.
No, I wouldn't say either, except some people might think so, looking at the sexual innuendos and the religious innuendos.
That's mentally ill?
I don't know. Don't look at me. I'm not...
Well, you just said that. You just said that. So you,
no,
you
but
must...
some people might think...
Some people might think a whole lot of shit. That doesn't mean... come on. What are you putting your imperatives on?
No. I'm just asking in terms of psychophobia. People look at your art or... they may, wow. And then they...
An artist's job is to provoke. Some people, I don't know who thinks artists' jobs are to put nice paintings above people's couches, but that's bullcrap. Even though there are plenty of artists who do that and make very good money doing that. But I really do think an artist's job is maybe to provoke and to make people think. And that's what I do. And I think I do it pretty darn well. And so I'm doing my job. And go hang to anybody else who thinks any differently. That's why when James and other people who we know bristle at the themes, I say there are plenty of nice rolling hills and landscapes and flowers and clowns hole, and there's plenty of that over there. Go over there and look at it. But if you want something more, then here, you can come over here. But if there's plenty of other good stuff for you to look at. You know, so don't give me a hard time about what you don't like.
Well, life, how much time do you spend thinking about sex?
Not that, I don't know. Let me think. Sex in terms of what? Actual sex? Because I spend a lot of time admiring women's beauty of all types. And as an artist, I think it behooves us to that's part of the whole, that's part of the package, to admire beauty of all types. And it could be an obesely fat woman. It could be a tall, gawky, whatever. And not just women, but men. But just talking, because I'm a straight heterosexual man, I'm just talking in women. I admire beauty. I look at people. I look at women. And if I see a woman that is particularly attractive, well, I wouldn't necessarily want to have sex with her, but I will. There will be a feeling of a feeling of desire, a feeling of lust. That, lust, but not in a sexual way, but just in a desirous way. You know, but I won't think about putting my penis in her vagina or in her mouth or in her anus. I don't think like that. But there is a desire to just want to, you know, hold them and caress them and love them in an old-fashioned Casanova kind of way. I don't think Casanova ever fucked any of his women, to be honest with you.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. But I think he just really made love to them, just loved them up and made them feel wanted and made them feel desired. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. I don't think, unless it's somebody who I'm involved with, like with KD or with any of my other girlfriends, will I think about actual intercourse, because I've had intercourse with them, and I'm remembering how good it was, and wanting to have more of that. But when it comes to women on the outside, which is what I'm thinking about, when I'm thinking about sex, I'm not really thinking about sex per se, as just a desirous kind of feeling it and loving it and wanting to hold them and wanting to. Yes. Yeah, just that's what I'm feeling. And if that's sex, then I don't know. But I don't think it's sex.
Well, we've talked about you.
It's passion.
But what about the wounded side of you and the wounded side of...
Boy, you really ducked that question, didn't you? I think we were on to something.
Okay, no.
You just ducked that shit.
Okay, let's go back to it.
Let's talk about the wounds. Let's open the wounds. Get the salt.
No. So we have a song actually that begins with that you and I did a while ago, in which it starts out as a conversation where you're asking me what I think about when I'm having sex with somebody.
Dan, do we have that song?
Yeah, I can play it for you.
Well, what song is it called?
I can't remember what the name of it. But you're asking me what I think, and then you say, well, let me tell you what I think. What goes on in your mind?
I don't remember that conversation, but anyways, or that song. I don't know where you're going with this question.
No.
When you're trying to random access something I don't remember, it's going to be tough to answer that.
No. The point I'm saying is that, you know, so there's this empathy. There's this almost a sensual bonding in the sense of becoming one with the.
Yes, that to me is the best sex. That to me is the best sex. More so, you can have sex with anybody. There's an expression that someone said, this is going to sound crude, but I'm going to run the risk. Pussy is like pizza. More or less the same. It's better in some places than in others, but it's more or less the same thing. You know what you're going to get. And you can have sex. And I'm sure women feel that way about penises. Some are larger than others, some are small, but you know what you're going to get. Something's going to come out of there, and the guy's going to fall asleep. But you can have sex, and sex, you can always get sex, but there's more to it for me than that. And that union, that making love, that bonding that I search for, that I really yearn for, that I really need to complete me, is to be a part of somebody else. It completes me to bond with somebody else. I'm not saying I don't have a sense of myself. I do have a strong sense of myself, but maybe too strong a sense of myself. But when it comes to a partner or a mate, I really want to become a mate, a partner, a soulmate, if possible, with that other person. I've had a hard time finding that. I've had a very hard time finding that.
Why is that?
Who knows? Who knows? Could be me. Maybe probably is. I'm not going to put it on anybody else. Probably is something in me that prevents that. I know for a long time it was the fact that I wasn't satisfied with the partner I was with and would go searching for others, which would ruin the bond of the relationship I'm running from and not quite make as strong as it could be the relationships you're running to, because you're always going to have to depart from them to go back to the one or two. It just gets crazy. Yeah, it just gets crazy. Carrying on simultaneous relationships. Which is why I stopped. I was the king of that. Or at least the prince. And,
Or a prick in the eyes of some women.
Definitely don't ever want to go back to that. Don't ever want to go back to that. I think I will be resolute in saying that that is a definite promise to myself. That I will never, ever, ever. And it's happening already, in that I made that promise to Sue, and other women came along, and I was like, no, I got Sue, that's it. I dumped a whole bunch. Mo, who was fantastic, I loved Mo, and I still love Mo. I still wish we could be friends because we were great friends, but without the sausage, she doesn't want anything to do with me. So it has to end. You know, and other Mia, many others. Fisticuffs, yeah, but I said no. I'm a one man woman, one woman man rather, or something like that. And but then yeah, I wasn't satisfied with Sue, and so when Katie came along and really just kind of represented, and I believe, I really hope that she's the one, because I my heart can't take. I'll always give my heart, but it's just I really believe in what's happening with Katie and I, and I just hope she believes in it. That's kind of really where I'm at with that. I kind of think that I'm, when you're a one-woman man.
You can't figure that out, that when I'm one man woman or one woman.
No, when you're a one-woman man, there are no other options. And you're giving 110% of yourself. And you'd like to know that the person you're giving this to appreciates that and is also giving that. Or, not, if not 110%, then at least 100%.
Yeah, it's hard to give 110%. I'm giving 110, I think. But just to get 100, or close to that. But when you when you're thinking you're not getting as much in return from your investment, it's daunting, and it's scary, because you don't know if this is indicative of how it's going to be for the rest of your life, or how it may turn out sometime in the future, and you may have to think about who knows what, you know, getting divorced, if you're going to get married, getting divorced, or breaking up and having to separate your shit, or any number of things that make it troublesome, you know. And I mean, Katie and I had a real major speed bump in the last month or so, in that. Another thing about her, which I guess since we're telling tales out of school, and this is turning into a Katie conversation, she's very much like me, and that's what I'm afraid of. That's what I'm afraid of, because I know what I'm like. I know my good points, and I see that in her, but I also know my weak points, and I kind of see a little bit of that in her as well.
What are the weak points in you, not in her?
Well, I lie.
Oh, you do?
I lie.
You do? Since when?
No, I try to be honest. I try to convince myself. Even now, I'm trying to convince myself that I try to be honest. But I lie. And if put up against the wall, I will lie. And I hope Katie will be straight. I try to be straight with her. I try to be a little too straight with her. And sometimes, if you show your hand, especially early in a relationship, you have nothing else but your hand. And if it's not a winning hand, I like to think I have a winning hand, but everybody likes to think they have a winning hand, right? Even the losers think they have a winning hand. You know?
Right, yeah, that's true. It was.
So,
guy goes in there and he's betting his heart out.
He's betting his heart out. He ain't got nothing, man. He ain't got shit.
Just his belief in himself.
You know? So I like to think I've got something, but maybe I don't have something, or maybe I do have something, but not enough for her. You know, so I am insecure about that, but I'll play it out. It sure beats going back to Sue. I don't mean to say that to put Sue down, but to actually give Sue a big up, as if to say, I don't want to put her through any more pain anymore. So, you know, rather than this breakup and say, come back to Sue and say, you want to give it a shot after I've broken her heart and rendered her and just kind of. Just leave her be and let her get on.
But what about you? You're the one who goes back.
No, 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 no. I think you misunderstand what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying. That's what I'm saying.
Well, then don't deviate. I don't dishonor what I just said by trying to be cute.
No, no, I'm not being cute. I'm just saying is that historically speaking, you have always had a woman to go to, even when you didn't.
I like women. Excuse me.
No, but I'm just saying is that...
I like women. So, I like the comfort of a woman. I need the comfort of a woman. As an artist, I need a muse.
But I've never seen you without a woman.
Is there anything wrong with that?
No.
Then why are you questioning it?
I'm just pointing out a reference point.
Well, for what, I wonder?
For what?
What are you pointing out?
Well, I'm just talking about somebody who you don't want to go back to for out of respect for her... But yet, you have a history of jumping ship.
Jumping ship from what?
And from
others?
Back to Sue, as if she's home. Calling a spade a spade.
Well, she's always been there.
And that's why she's in your paintings, too.
She's been in a lot of my paintings, yeah. Not in a while, though. Not in a while.
She's all over Cosmic Knockout.
Well, that was like, what, 10 years ago? Of course she would be. She's the only person I had. I was locked up. You would be too if you'd be on the ward, and you're the only person I had to talk to.
Do you, in your paintings now, are you painting Katie?
Yes. She's embodied, and I'm seeing a lot of her influence in a lot of my paintings. All of my paintings since I've met her, actually.
And how long has this been going on with Katie?
I've known her since the middle of May.
Middle of May?
Mm-hmm.
when I came there, came introduced, or I was there with. Mm-hmm. And what was it about Katie that got your attention?
You know, if we knew the answers to this, we'd bottle it and sell it.
Well, I'm trying to bottle it and sell it.
Oh, good luck. Good luck. Not getting any help from me.
Not getting any help from me. I'm trying. What do you mean, not getting any help from me? I'm recording this.
No, what? She was just an incredible presence. She was an amazing presence. She was an amazing presence. There was just something about her, and there is, not just was, but there is something about her that's magical. That, and I can't stress it, that's spiritual, that's magical, that's so much like going home for me, the kinship that we had, which is very important for someone especially who's lost his family, you know, and lost my mother in a way that I did. I'm not denying that that's a part of it, but even more so than that, it's just she's just super cool and super sexy and super smart and super talented, and super confident. And confidence is a drug, and her confidence is very strong. I really appreciate that. And she's just an amazing person. She's an amazing person. I'm glad I traded up. I don't regret it at all. I'm glad I traded up.
Well, we're talking about your evolution and your development of your paintings as an experience that you've had, and now Katie is
a part of that experience.
As part of that experience. So we're bringing that to the present, right. Is if you follow my...
So what are you saying?
Well, I'm just saying is, Katie's in which paintings do you see her?
All of them. I could point them out if I were to see, if they were in front of me, I could point out, like, what I was going through in the relationship at the time that conjured that image that made me want to...
You have a few that I
can... Well, let's not do it. That's kind of pointless because it's an audio activity. And it's,
right, okay.
But definitely, she's in every painting that I've done since I've met her.
So you're out now, how long?
Over 3 years.
And you're stable in terms of...
Right as rain.
And you're on your meds.
Yeah.
You get a shot. That keeps you... Do we want to talk about that?
Not really.
Okay, we don't need to.
That's a little too... it's like asking somebody about their blood pressure medication or something.
Yeah, what blood pressure medication are you on?
Nothing right now, but you're making it rise. Rise right now.
You know me.
I may be on some
you may be
soon. Stat.
So, all I'm pointing out is here, you have a history. You also believe...
Doesn't everybody have a history of something?
Right. No, where I'm going is... in the relationship to psychophobia, the stigma of mental illness.
Right.
What do people need to know about that?
I don't really think about that. I'm really just thinking about being a painter at this point. I'm not really thinking about the angle of the mentally ill painter who's been through hell and killed his mother and had to go to a mental hospital for 20 years. I'm not there. And I have to thank Katie for that. Or if not Katie directly, then Katie's influence. And being able to paint paintings that have little, I'm sure something to do with that, but in my mind, little or nothing to do with that. I'm sure there's a little bit of that in there because it's coming from me. And that's a part of my life, it's a part of my history, it's a part of my experience, and you bring everything with you with everything you do and you paint. But it's so minimal in my mind that it's not an issue. So to talk about it in relation to the paintings I've been doing in the last 2 or 3 months would be pointless. Maybe even 2 or 3 years since I've gotten out.
Where I'm going with that is, what do people need to know about mental illness that from your perspective? You know, what's your relationship and what is the psychophobia that goes on?
You have to be a little more specific, because that's a very general and kind of wide-ranging question.
Well,
you're asking
personally and both.
No, but I don't quite know where you're going, what you're trying to say.
Let's try it again.
Make it a little more specific.
Okay.
Ask me a specific question, I'll answer.
Right. So, in your life, you've spent a lot of time around people with mental illness.
Including now.
Undoubtedly. Now, what is your observations about mental illness, including the person you're with right now? Present company excluded.
What was the question?
What is your observations about mental illness?
My observations. It is what it is. It depends on the person too. I've seen people, myself included, who's been tortured by it. And I've seen people who love the voices they listen to. They wait for them. They listen and learn from them and enjoy the voices. And laugh and laugh and laugh like they've never laughed at anything in their lives. And are so happy that those voices are there. So it's everybody's personal experience. It's not something that I could observe and say anything about. It's just everybody's experience is different with it. I've been tortured. I've laughed, too.
Have you been one of those guys?
There have been moments when I crack myself up when I do my paintings. And when your paintings come to life, it's funny. You know, Malcolm X is Batman with his glasses on above the mask. You know, things like that. I see that. I see people walking into my bedroom in similar situations. It's, that's funny, you know. So,
So part of your paintings are also part of your sense of humor?
Sure.
In all your paintings?
Sure.
Even the ones that are pretty tortured?
Sure. I laugh at very bizarre and dark things. And you have to. I've learned that you have to. I think I was always that way. I always had dark humor. I was very influenced by Monty Python and strange humor, absurdist humor, and also dark humor, black humor. And a lot of things I laugh at and find funny are dark, you know. And I also realize that if you can't laugh at the dark stuff, you're kind of lost because there's so much darkness around us anyway. So you gotta laugh at it. You gotta find the humor in it or the levity in it to kind of neutralize it. You know, so that's what I do. And that's a major theme and a major part of my work.
Even though there's a sexual theme often and a superhero theme and a super comic character,
the alter ego, which is very big. It's all subconscious. You know. It's all, you know.
So now we're getting to the heart of this. It's all subconscious.
Well, it's all subconscious, sure.
Talk to me about that.
I don't know if I'm qualified. You'll need a psychologist to do that. I'm sure. There was actually one young lady who came to the museum from Germany who did her thesis on the Living Museum and used me as one of her subjects. And she was spot on. I can't even quote the theories and concepts she was laying down because they were they're too deep to quote. But I could refer to them maybe in writing at some later point. But she really saw it. The split of the self and wanting to divorce myself from the things that I did. Spot on. And so a lot of my subconscious factors into my work, and as do most artists. And I think any artist who says that they don't would be lying or just doesn't know what they're talking about. You know? How could the subconscious not factor into everything we do? The choices we make when we go to the supermarket. You know?
Well, do you think of yourself as a sexual person?
I have sex. I like to have sex. I've had sex. So, yeah. Aren't we all?
What is it about sex that you like?
I like making that connection. I like making a connection. I like making a partner feel good more than anything. I really, more than anything. Not so much my getting off. I like to get off. I think all men like to get off. All people like to get off. But more than anything, I'd like my partner to be totally, completely fulfilled and satisfied. Yeah, and let me do whatever it takes to get her there. Yeah. That's really what it's all about for me. And then, when they're satisfied and they're bathing in the afterglow, then I can take my shit out and say, okay, now we've got to do something about this. Yeah,
And I won't say it's like that for me, where it takes a second, but it doesn't take very much for a man to come. You know, so I don't. I'd much rather. I don't know. Just explore that.
Do you?
I'm a giver. I'm a sexual giver. There's some who are takers. I'm a giver. Most who are takers. But I like to give.
And do you get the sense that maybe there's a sexual overtone in the act of painting for you?
Sexual overtone in the act?
Of painting.
Yes, when I'm painting a woman, I'm caressing that body, boy. When I'm doing Wonder Woman's legs, especially, because she's got some strong legs, I am just like swiping that paintbrush over her legs. I'm stroking her slow. I'm doing a big swath first, just to get like just to block the color, just like a nice, warm, healthy swath of feeling, just to kind of get the color in, and then I go into a deeper, a more delicate caress. Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm making love to her. I'm making love to her. And I'm doing those tits, and I'm doing those areolae. Oh yeah, I'm just getting in there. Slowly circling till I get to the nipple, till I get to the tip of the nipple. I have a certain way of doing it too, where I go from the outside, circle around to the center. And that's how it makes it look better when you paint it, because you're actually doing it, you know? You're actually creating. It's like you're, I don't want to say like a god, but you're like, you are creating the woman on the paper. And if you're gifted enough, and I think I have some degree of talent, if you're gifted enough to do it, you can create it so that it's there. And that's how I paint it, like creating it, like caressing it, like making that nipple come alive from the outside to the tip. So it is a sexual thing. Well, I won't say sexual, it's a sensual thing. Because sexual connotates, I think that's wrong when you say it. It's a sensual thing. It's very much making love to the canvas, making love to yourself. Ultimately, yeah.
So, let's leave it on that note. Painting is making love to yourself.
Did I say that? Well, it's for masturbation. Eh? That's easy reading, the masturbatory artist. Thank you, Gio.
You're welcome.
Once again, you've lifted the bar.
Once again. Well, I just thought that would be a good spot to... because you were making love to it. I was really... that was your mind. My mind was much more resonant and sympathetic to the act of making love to the canvas. And to your imagination. So I was actually resonating with you, talking about the bar.
Ah, okay.
You just went under the bar. Mm-hmm. I went over the bar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think that I know for me when I'm painting, it's kind of tickling the imagination. My imagination. And maybe the imagination in others.
Well, when you do... I know you do a lot of drawings, but when you do a painting like this, let's say, how deep and sensual do you get into it?
Well, this is a painting of flowers, but if you move the painting a little bit over, you'll see that it's conceptual art. I know you don't like conceptual art.
Oh, I hate it.
But this, to me, is very conceptual art.
Mm.
Because what do you have? You have these overdrawn flowers, these trees on the sides, almost. And then you have these little people who are walking under the flower.
Oh, the people. I've seen that before in another painting.
In many of my paintings. Yeah. And they're going through a door.
Oh, I see. Then I see the door.
They're going through a door.
I see the door.
Where are they going?
Right. I see. Okay, I thought this was just flowers. I thought this was just a study in flowers.
Oh, no. Oh, this is much better.
I wouldn't say it's conceptual.
No, but I look at a lot of art. Your art especially is conceptual art. Because there's a feeling and a concept that goes along with it as an observer who is inside the painting. I have paintings where I would make a, in the, or in some other area, I put a chair and a table and a plate and a fork or a knife and a glass of wine. And that was for the observer to sit in, the painting.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, so the, as if the, that was the meal that they were having. The meal was that they were part of the painting. The experience was a place for them to sit. So I, as a recovering artist, I always look at painting really as from the inside out.
Mm.
So when I look at your painting, especially the one that I rescued from
the clutches of
What is that painting?
Satan turning into a dog.
And you painted it when you were melting down.
Clearly. Started off with the dog, which is very clear and very detailed. And then the Satan part got very, very freaky and wild. And I was working with oils and spilling stuff on it to get this weird effect. And, it was very experimental and very meltdown-ish. That's kind of the impression I had of Satan. Yeah. Emerging out of my closet. Just like that. Yeah. Which was pretty scary, because he did it every night. Yeah. To the point where I had to sleep in my closet, I had to check my closet. It was like I was a kid again, checking the closet for the boogeyman. Yeah. In a mental hospital.
In a mental hospital.
Yeah. So there you go.
Schizophrenia. What is that? You're shaking your head.
No, it's too general a question to ask. I can't answer that.
Or what is it for you?
Well, it's a diagnosis I have, but I don't know if it's a proper diagnosis, really. I've been told by plenty of psychiatrists that I don't have the tells of someone with schizophrenia. They say people with schizophrenia have like certain tells, certain things that they have and do, or just built in that I don't have. So I could be schizoaffective. Schizophreniform, which I think would be closer to the truth. But either way, I do have a disorder, clearly.
Are you comfortable with that?
Sure, no problem. As long as I take a medication, I mean, because I've bugged out enough times and been re-upped on medication enough times to know that, hey, this medication helps me not bug out. So that's let me know I need to take medication. I've teased it out enough times on pot and on not taking my medication to know that pot fucks me up. And not taking my meds makes me crazy again. So.
Not taking your meds. You're taking your meds. You once told me a story that when you started taking your meds seriously, over objection, after you got the shot, you went back to the staff and apologized.
Yeah. I felt embarrassed because of how I was acting those 6 or 8 months while I was not taking my medication and bugging out on the Cosmic Knockout. Bugging out thinking I was Superstar and the Tar Baby and Meathead and all these other creatures that I created. And the things I was doing and saying in my sexual state, I was exposing myself to just about every woman who'd come around. I was disrespecting the male staff, making a general nuisance of myself, going insane. And they were used to that, of course. But part of me felt like I'd been there for several years and been very well compensated and gained their trust. I was the trustee. I was the guy they gave the keys to go down the hall and let the other guys in because they were too lazy to get up off their ass. I was the key guy, you know?
And all of a sudden, I'm bugging out and acting this. That wasn't supposed to happen to me. And so it was such a profound turnaround from what they were used to and how I presented that I really felt like it was embarrassing. So I just went around and apologized to everybody. And they took it well. And most, if not all of them, probably said, they all said, it's okay. We know why you're here, and this is where you're at. And that's why this place is made for things like that to happen, so that they happen in here, not outside. And you're not jumping in front of a subway or pushing somebody accidentally in front of a subway. God knows what else would happen. Yeah, that's what these places are for, and that's what you were here for. And so don't worry about it. No sweat. Yeah.
Now, what year? When did you first get your shot?
1998.
Yeah. So where I'm going with that is that all of a sudden you kind of matured and stabilized.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you look at your first 10 years.
I wasn't out of my mind in the first 10 years, but I'd had inconsistent thoughts and moments of inconsistency and straight out bug outs. But it was just inconsistency. You know, but the last 10 years I was totally consistent. I was on a good medication, and I was thinking right as rain. Yeah. I couldn't get out.
I like to say, for the first 10 years...
I know you do, because that sounds poetic. The first 10 years I was insane, the last 10 years I was insane, man. I know that sounds poetic, but that's not the truth.
No, it's not?
It's not the truth.
Then why am I saying that?
Because you like saying stuff that's fucked up.
Oh, right. Thank you.
No, you like to go for the shock value and the poetry as opposed to what may be more truthful, which is that it's not that I was insane the first 10 years, but there were a lot of moments of inconsistency. There were also a lot of moments of, okay, I was fine. I was working my way out. And then I'd have a setback. I'd smoke pot, and I'd have a setback. I'd to get on the meds again, and I'd stop taking my meds, and I'd have a setback. I'd get on my meds again, I'm fine. And I'm having an affair with the social worker, I have a setback. I have an affair with a nurse, I have a setback. I was having a lot of setbacks. And that could have something to do with the fact that maybe my thinking wasn't together, like in terms of like my judgment. I think my judgment wasn't there, maybe. But I had to tease it out. These are things they have to learn. They're learning experiences. You know, when you're a pot smoker and you grow up in a house full of pot smokers and pot is a part of your life, whether you're smoking a lot or not, it was a part of my life. And then all of a sudden they're telling you, you can't smoke pot anymore. It's like, get the fuck out of here, I can't smoke. Give me that joint. You know, and then you flip out and say, wow, I can't smoke pot anymore. And you just own up to it. And you just kind of like deal with it. You know, and then when someone's coming up to you and you feel like a piece of shit and you feel like you're low and you're nothing and someone's saying, you're kind of cute, you want to fuck? You better believe I want to fuck. Where's that pussy? Show me that pussy. I'll fuck it. And then you get caught and you get in trouble and you feel low and you feel bad and somebody else comes in, you look kind of cute, you want to fuck? You better believe I want to fuck. Where's that? Show me that pussy. Yeah, and you have a couple of episodes of that and then you realize, okay, maybe I shouldn't be doing that. Or maybe I should be a little more clandestine, a little more discreet, you know, which is what happened later on. It's not that I gave up the pussy hunting, but it's just that I became a little more discreet, you know. And thank goodness Sue came along and... You know, for a while she was willing to go and do whatever it took to do whatever it took. You know, for her own needs and for my needs. But then when she started melting down and it became a real drag to be with her, I started searching for other people to be with while still being with her, mainly because I felt like I couldn't leave her because she was going to kill herself. And that's the God's honest truth. I tried at several points to say, hey, look, you know, this ain't working. And it was just, she didn't go and couldn't go. And then I felt bad because I realized, wow, you know, if something happens, I'd be in rough shape. Not just for me, but it would just be bad to have that happen anyway. So she stuck around. I let her stick around, but I also looked around for other people to be involved with. And that's how... the German doctor got involved, and Mo, and various others. Not various, but a few others. I had other steadies while having Sue as a steady.
In the beginning of our conversation, you talked about conquest. What does that mean?
I just said that. I don't necessarily think... I don't know if I mean that necessarily, conquest. But
Maybe I do in a way, but I don't mean it in a way where it sounds so crude. But you want to conquer the pussy. You want to conquer that demon because it's so foreign from anything you've known. You know, you don't have one of those. What the women have. You don't have one of those. You don't see it very often either. You could see it a lot in your life. I've seen it a lot in my life. But it's still not something. It's still a foreign beast, you know. And so you want to conquer that beast. You want to know that thing is not going to swallow you whole.
But you stick your most private member.
Well, that's your staff. Disappears. No, that's your staff. That's not your most private member. That's your weapon. That's your weapon to slay the beast. And hopefully you can slay the beast. And that's the conquest.
That is in contradiction with your other kind of emotional...
Well, aren't we all contradictions? Aren't we all... You know, that's why I didn't want to go there, because it does sound crude. But that's just one way of looking at it. That's like the male id talking right now. But if we stop for a moment, and if we go back, or if we go forward, you can talk to the mushy-gushy inside guy, you know, who's probably got a much more empathetic and compassionate take on it, which is often the case with me. There's usually those two guys who exist, Captain Nebbish and Superstud.
Captain Nebbish, I know. This is the first time I've heard of Captain Nebbish.
Well, that's the name Katie and I have given him.
Of giving Longfellow?
No, me.
Oh.
That's the me when I don't have my penis out, with all the insecurities and my Jewish self.
Your Jewish self.
Yeah, that's Captain Nebbish.
Captain Nebbish.
Who's a very sweet guy. He's the sweet guy that I think you've seen him a lot. He's the sweet guy that doesn't mean any harm and really wants to help and really wants to love people. But when Superstud comes out, when it comes time to kind of do the business, you know, conquer. Or just, you know, level the playing field.
Now, we should mention here, or at some point in time, that the reason why we're doing this is you came to me in a conversation that we were having about you're having a show.
Yeah, in October at the Javits Center.
And
hopefully more afterwards, if that goes
right,
well.
Right, and that we were talking about...
Can we cut this short? Because this is going on forever.
Well, that's what I'm doing. Okay. And that we were talking about, well, you should really have kind of an insight into your art.
I don't think we achieved that in this conversation, but we can say we did. Let's not say we did.
Well, and so I just want to make it clear that this is done because...
Is this a disclaimer?
Yes.
Oh, God.
It's just
to protect you, Geo Geller, 2016-9-209.
The spy from the future.
Exactly.
No. The point is, I think it's not like I'm.
Right. Okay, yeah. We've got that. In case anybody finds this, yes, I did it all on my own accord.
With a little help from your friend.
Yes.
Who has a tape recorder? Who knows you well enough to.
Tie me to the radiator. Which knows you well enough to shackle me to the radiator every time I come
we've
over.
We've got a song called that.
Yes, we do.
I think that I just wanted to clarify that.
Sure, okay.
That this is your doing.
Let it go, let it go.
Okay, good. So this is episode one in...
in the first and last of many episodes.
Right. We thank you for listening, even if you didn't.
Yes, thank you. Have a good day. Love you. Take care. Bye-bye. Adios. Arrivederci. Sayonara.
Ciao.